Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today on the show, we're joined by Jill Christopher, CEO of Ronald McDonald House Charities in Fargo. Ronald McDonald House Charities provide crucial support to families in medical crisis, and their endeavors are genuinely uplifting, and we wanted to know more about their impactful work and community contributions. Jill, welcome to Main Street.
Well, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jill, and I think many listeners have heard about Ronald McDonald Houses, maybe here or across the country. But give me a brief overview of what is the Ronald McDonald House Charities of the Red River Valley.
Sure. So Ronald McDonald House Charities of River Valley, we provide housing and support for families who have children in the hospital. So we do that through our Ronald McDonald House, which is the program most people have heard from. It's a space where families can come and stay while their child is in the hospital. We really want to make sure families can focus on what matters most, and that's getting their child well. In addition, we have our Ronald McDonald Family Room. So our Ronald McDonald Family Room is a space within Essentia Health here in town that supports families who have children in the NICU, which is a nice way to extend some of our services outside of just the Ronald McDonald House. It really comes down to, you know, making sure families have a place where they can rest, where they can handle a lot of those things, where they don't have to worry about cost. There's no charge to stay at the Ronald McDonald House. They don't have to worry about the mounting bills that they have when you might not be working. You know, you're eating out, you have maybe gas when you're coming back and forth. So a number of things that families need to worry about, we want to make sure that they don't have to worry about those.
Jill, what's your background? You've been here for quite a while.
Yeah. So I have been here for 13 years. Prior to that, I actually went to Concordia here in Moorhead, Minnesota, and then worked for Thrivent Financial, a financial services company, and just felt that tug that, you know, had that service, that volunteer work, and kind of was just tugging. So joined the board, actually, for the Ronald McDonald House. And then when the job came open, I had to go for it and been here ever since.
This is a beautiful facility. Let's give our listeners a virtual tour.
Absolutely.
We walk in the front door, and what do we see?
One of the things that's great, we opened this location in May of 2018.
And you built it.
We built it, yeah. So we got to build this, which really gives us this welcoming space. When you walk in, there's a front desk, which sounds silly, but our old locations didn't have that. They were modified, you know, modified house, a modified apartment building. So it gives us where there's a welcoming face right at the front desk to say hi, you know, what place to know, where families go. On our first floor is really all of our community spaces. So we have this expansive kitchen that allows for multiple families to cook at once. We have a whole volunteer kitchen. We have volunteers that come in and cook almost every day of the year. So that really allows a gathering space. You know, we have 5 dining room tables. So families can connect with each other. You know, they can sit down as a family and eat. They can meet new people that are also have sick kids.
That's probably really helpful.
It's really helpful. You know, one of my favorite, this is from quite a few years ago, but, you know, when your child is sick, sometimes it's easy to talk about and sometimes it's not. But here, everyone's child is sick. And, you know, I remember quite a few years ago now, we had 3 families who had children in the eating disorder program at Sanford at the same time. The connection they built, like they had tears when they left because they were leaving these friends they'd made. And it was so nice to get to see them find someone who could, they could really truly talk to about the struggles and the successes, and people would understand all of that.
So let's resume our tour.
Yes.
We're in the community area, in the kitchen area. It's so beautiful.
The kitchen, I love the kitchen. But, you know, off the kitchen, there's a playroom. There's a game room. We have outside, we have a play set for kids. So it really feels like your house potentially, but just bigger. And then upstairs, we have guest rooms. So we have 24 guest rooms, so 12 on each floor. The guest rooms look very much like a hotel. They have their own private bathroom, which we did not have in our previous location. So that's very exciting. Doesn't sound very big, but it was really a huge win. We have an elevator to get to those rooms, which we didn't have before. So we love that. And, you know, the rooms have 2 queen beds, just a very cozy space. And then in addition to those 12 guest rooms on each floor, we have a living room and a laundry room. So we have, you know, a space where they can expand out of their room and watch TV, play a board game, do what you would do at home with your family. And then, of course, laundry. All of our laundry is free, but, you know, you do need to do laundry. So some of our families are here for many, many, many weeks.
I'm guessing that you have folks that can plan, if that's a good word to use, their need for your services, but others maybe didn't realize they were going to be here yesterday.
Absolutely. Yeah, it can be very sudden when families end up here. And that can be stressful. It's not only stressful for the family, but their whole support system. Everyone's trying to help and they're trying to figure things out. We work very closely with our hospital partners. So they figure out who, particularly with the Ramsdale House, who's coming in from out of town to get this specialty care that's offered here in Fargo. You know, we're very fortunate to have the medical care we do. For those families to be able to come in, we work with social work and the different staff over at the hospital to make sure that they know that this is an option for them.
So you said earlier there is no cost. So literally anyone can benefit.
Yeah, there's no income requirement. I mean, we really feel like everyone with a sick child can benefit from the community environment that the Ronald McDonald House brings. So yeah, they're not required to pay here. Of course, if they wanted to make a donation, we would always say yes. But there's no requirement to pay. And last year, 90% of our families paid absolutely nothing when they stayed here. They don't, you know, and that's great. That's what we want.
How many folks did you serve last year?
So we served about 750 families last year.
And that might have been for one day or 2 weeks or more.
We actually had one family last year that finished up a 20-month stay with us. It's everything from one day to a couple nights to literally months. It really depends on the course of treatment for their child and what they need to figure out in order to move to the next step.
Have you ever been so full you had to say, I'm so sorry, not today?
Yeah, actually, yes. So one of the things that was nice, you know, that was pretty common in our old locations. We moved here, it helped a lot. When we originally moved here, we opened 17 rooms, and we've since been able to add an additional 7 up to 24, and that's helped a lot. So it's pretty rare. But yeah, actually, just a couple weeks ago, we had to turn a few families away, which is always a bummer. And it's not that we turn them away forever, but it's just deferring them. So we have to wait till somebody checks out. Yeah, you have the room as long as you need it. So we can't really take reservations. You know, you never know how long you're going to be in the hospital. Sure. Sometimes it can go both ways. You think you're getting home tomorrow and you're here for another week, or you think you're going home in a week and you get to go home tomorrow. So it really, you know, things can change really quickly.
You came to work today from your home, as did others on your staff. Give me an idea of what a normal day looks like from your staff here at Ronald McDonald House.
Great question. Really, from our team, we're staffed 24 hours a day. And so a lot of it is, you know, kind of this turnover of switching, you know, for the person who's leaving to the people who are coming, what they saw. So our days are filled with cleaning. You know, we have David on our team who does a fabulous job of cleaning during the day. You know, he's the one making sure all the rooms look great and ready, and we just want it to be a beautiful, comfortable space. You know, we're talking to the hospital, making sure that if there's families that need to get here, talking to the families, checking them in. When they come, we have a little meeting with them, making sure they understand where things are, what's available to them here. Because in addition to the kitchen, you know, we have a fully stocked pantry. We have everything you might have forgot. Toothpaste, deodorant, all of those things when you go on vacation or go on a trip that you might have forgotten, we try to have on stock because they might not have time or capacity or money to go and get those things at that particular moment. So yeah, so the day is just a lot of that, a lot of, you know, connecting with families. And then we try to have some fun stuff throughout the day, see if there, you know, is activities that we can do. We have an arts and crafts room. So we have team members that make craft ideas for the kids so they can go in there and have some fun. And
so what is that age break point of folks that maybe are too older to have your services or would be welcome?
Great question. Yeah. So we work with families who have children 21 and younger. So if you're anywhere in that kind of pediatric, so it's everything from NICU babies who are born prematurely, cancer, eating disorders, feeding therapy, surgeries, all of those things. But anyone 21 and younger.
We're enjoying our conversation with Jill Christopher. She's the chief executive officer of the Ronald McDonald Charities of the Red River Valley. Jill, I'm guessing that folks who need medical care here in Fargo or West Fargo or Moorhead can stay at home. It's the folks that come from maybe farther away. Give us an idea of where folks come from that have services here.
The vast majority of families we work with are coming from northwestern Minnesota and then the entire state of North Dakota. So it might be as close as, you know, Grand Forks, or we have families from Dickinson, Minot, all over western North Dakota. But the vast majority of our families are from North Dakota and northwest Minnesota.
There is one other Ronald McDonald's Charities in North Dakota. It's in Bismarck. but they're operated independently. Tell me about that and what it means to you as a CEO.
Yeah. So one of the things that is really nice, I think, about Ronald McDonald House is that we operate as our own 501c3. So Bismarck is its own 501c3. Fargo is its own 501c3. And what that means is that when you donate to your local Ronald McDonald House, that money stays there. You know, when you donate to Fargo, it stays in Fargo. But we also have this wonderful community of people we can call. So if I have an issue, I have a question, I need an idea, I'm stuck on something, there is this network of literally hundreds of other Ronald McDonald Houses that I can reach out to. So it might be talking to Kathy in Bismarck or Kevin in Sioux Falls or Jill in Minneapolis. They're all really close. We all work with a lot of the same families. So we can talk about how we would handle a certain situation, what we would do, what ideas have been working for them.
Give us a little more of a history of how Ronald McDonald Charities started. Where in the country did it begin?
Absolutely. So the first Ronald McDonald House was opened in 1974 in Philadelphia. And the story is fantastic. In fact, there is a feature film coming out about Dr. Audrey Evans, who was a huge part of opening that first Ronald McDonald House. She was a pediatric oncologist in the early 70s as a female when women couldn't even get their own credit card. She talked about that. She just passed away in the last year and a half in her 90s. But she was spunky. You know, she was ahead of the curve on pet therapy for kids. She was really instrumental in doing some really unique therapies for kids with cancer. At the time, there was a Philadelphia Eagles player that had a child named Kim that had cancer. And so they were being served, Fred and Fran Hill were their names. They were being served at the hospital there. And so the Eagles did a fundraiser for the hospital. And out of that became this idea from Dr. Evans that they still needed a place for these people to stay. People were noticing that families were sleeping in their cars, they were sleeping on the floor, and they needed a place to stay. And so they located a house and they needed a little bit more money. And at the time, the Eagles are doing a promotion with McDonald's for the new Shamrock Shake. So when you have your Shamrock Shakes, you could think of the Ronald McDonald House because that's how it all started. So it just this really unique partnership was born, and McDonald's has been part of it ever since.
Still today?
Still today. They're one of our biggest supporters. So that started, and it really took off like wildfire across the U.S. about how this was really something that children's hospitals could really use, a place for these families to stay. And locally, it started because of a few moms, one being Bev McAllister. Her daughter, Sarah, passed away from cancer very quickly. It's a lovely story that she tells about Sarah and her sparkle and this beautiful little girl that passed away at a year and a half. She, after Sarah passed away, she was in a grief group with a number of other mothers that had also lost their children. And they heard about the Ronald McDonald House going up in the Twin Cities. And so they went down to see it. And they brought the idea back to Wayne Allard, who was a social worker at what is now Samford. Wayne took it and ran with it and got all these volunteers. And so we actually opened in 1982. Really, when you think about the size of what Fargo was compared to Philadelphia at that time, we were really on the forefront. So we've been here 40 years already, which is amazing.
I'm sure much of your time, Jill, is spent making sure there are funds to continue what you do here.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, fundraising, we couldn't do what we do without the generosity of the amazing donors that make it happen. Because we're locally owned and operating, you know, we have to fundraise the vast majority of what we do locally. So yeah, it is a big part. We have a number of ways we do that, a number of really great partners. I talked about McDonald's. You know, when you go through the drive-through and you see that change box or they ask you to round up, that stays local. So we have 23 McDonald's that feed into this Ronald McDonald House, which is really a cool thing because you kind of think, where does that money go? You know, I'm dropping this in, what happens to it? It stays right here. And so that is a little over $60,000 a year in change when you think about it, like rounding up, change, dropping in those coins, those 23 stores. I mean, that's a lot of money. We have our Sweetheart Ball, which is coming up in February. That's our big gala fundraiser. I hold at the Delta on February 10th. You know, so that's a lot of corporate sponsors, individual people sponsoring tables, inviting their friends. We have about 600 people that come. And it's just a fun night to talk about the stories that families do. One of the cool parts of my job is getting to see that generosity. It's amazing what people will do and what they'll do with their hard-earned money to make sure that other families are okay.
Not only are there those great people, but there's also a volunteer force that helps you out. Tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. We are super fortunate to have an amazing volunteer base. In fact, last year we had over 2,300 volunteers that helped make what we do possible. At the Ronald McDonald House, we're open 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and we have a really small staff. And so in order to make that possible, volunteers extend our staff by so much. We had a group, they come every Friday and they mop our floors. Like, it sounds little, but for us, it's huge because it takes them, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes to mop our whole first floor. But if you took an hour out of our staff to do that, you know, two staff members for 45 minutes every week, that's a lot of time when, you know, when you're trying to balance that. So volunteers cook our meals every night. They come in and bake amazing food. They just make it smell fabulous in here every day. We have cleaning groups. This afternoon, we have a group that's coming in with some handy people, and they're going to fix some things and, you know, help with some cleaning, but also just tweak all of those little things that break. You know, everything that breaks at your house breaks at ours too. So it's great when we have people with talents that can help make sure that's all possible.
Have the needs of families changed, and how have you adapted to those needs?
You know, the interesting part is at the end of the day, it really hasn't changed that much. As much as we wish this wasn't true, there will always be sick kids. You know, while some of the communication styles have changed, we have an online registration form, or before you called us on the phone, some of those little things have changed. But at the end of the day, the core of what makes this place special has continued to be the same. You know, families connecting with other families, families having that safe spot, place to land. Right when I started, we had a little boy that would come every week for therapy. We had a therapy dog that would come to the house every night. It just happened to be the same night that he would come every week was the night that the dog there, and that special relationship, knowing what was going to happen when he got there, knowing what it was going to look like. I think for our families that have long-term therapies, long-term treatments, cancer treatments, there's so much back and forth. You get to go home for a few weeks, you come back. You get to go home for a few weeks, you come back. Having that spot that is always the same is so comforting. You know, all of our rooms look the same. No matter what room you get when you come back, it feels the same to the family. You know where the food is. You know what's happening. You know where the games are. You know, all of that really doesn't change. I mean, our building looks different. It's bigger. There's more families to connect with, which is fabulous. But at the end of the day, those basic needs are still the same.
There are some challenges that every organization has to, I guess, overcome. What are some of your challenges?
Staffing a 24/7 operation has changed. When I first started, we had staff that slept on site overnight, and now we're much bigger. And so we've had to change that. I think keeping, you know, that same web of communication, keeping everybody on the same page as your staff gets bigger, your volunteer base gets bigger. How do we make sure that we continue to do what we do very, very well? Continuing to grow and make sure that you're meeting the needs of the family is always that challenge. Goes back to what you're talking about with wait list. Whenever we have to tell family we don't have a spot for them is always hard. And so, you know, looking at what could we do? What are the options? Before we went on the air here, we were talking a little bit about COVID, which I think made us hyper aware. While we'd always been really aware of keeping this place top-notch clean, it just heightened that even more in terms of the vulnerable population that we're dealing with. I mean, all of these children are sick. Them getting sick on top of being sick, or their family members getting sick, can be a really, really bad deal. And so we have to do everything we can to make sure that we're taking care of our families really well.
I'm guessing that the need for your services is year-round, but is there a certain time of year that you're busier than others, or is it just really the entire year?
A few years ago, I would have said there were times where we were busier than others, but right now we are just busy all the time. I think the types of patients we see changes at different times of the year. You know, summer, there are some programs that might sound optional, but maybe I think it's just more that there's some flexibility on when you can get those treatments, like feeding therapy, things like that. Some of the other programs or some of the other needs are heightened during the school year when stress for children is higher, you know, when you're looking at eating disorders or some of the mental health things. But babies are born early every day. Cancer diagnosis has happened every day. And so it really just is pretty steady.
You bring up an interesting point that I really hadn't thought about. I've considered, you know, what you do for children who are undergoing cancer treatments or had been in a car accident, but also mental health treatments, et cetera. You provide services for those families.
We do. I think one of the things that I really enjoy about what we do is, you know, when your child is born prematurely or your child has cancer, I think there has been an a really big shift in how we can support those families, from GoFundMe pages and Caring Bridge sites, and people can tell their story in a way that works for them. But what we're still seeing is families who have children with mental health issues or diagnoses that they're working on or eating disorders. We're still not talking about that on a grand scale. And I think that gives us a really big opportunity here to talk about some of those challenges, some of those stresses that our young people are facing every day, and what consequences that can have on their body and their health from top to bottom. Being able to make sure that families can be here and near the care they need. You know, we are very fortunate in Fargo that we have excellent care. We work with Sanford, we work with Essentia, we work with Prairie St. John's, and they provide amazing treatment for families. It's really nice to be able to walk alongside them and make sure that these families have a place to stay. So that's not a barrier to getting that treatment.
We talked about challenges that you encountered just a moment ago, but you probably also have some goals. What are you looking forward to?
Yeah, you know, I think for us right now, what we're really looking at, what is the next thing that we want to work on? You know, we're at this really cool time. We built this beautiful space, and now we're, you know, we've learned how to use it very well. We've learned how to family, but we, you know, we have a wait list sometimes. And so what is the next steps for that? What does the future look like as we continue to grow? How do we expand our staff's capabilities? How do we start our learning, those kind of things? What are additional services that we could provide to our families to support them during their stay, you know, as they get here, as they leave? What do those things look like to make sure that families have what they need, and it's flexible, you know, to make sure we're taking care of them? And then what lies ahead? You know, I think it's a really fun time with our board to dream about what other things are needed in this area for families with sick kids. How can we use our services to help that?
If there are individuals or church groups or service organizations that want to help you, Jill, what should they do?
Yeah, absolutely. You could always go onto our website, rmhcfargo.org. Get more information there. Give us a call, 701-232-3980. If you have a group that wants a tour, you just want to come in and see what it looks like, you've heard a little bit on the airwaves and you want to come in and see what it looks like, we love to show it off. We're so proud of this building. So happy to always to give a tour. We're always looking for volunteers. So if you bake or you cook or you have a special talent you want to share, you know, it's fun to have people who can perform music or lead an art class. Or if you want to come and help us clean, we're always looking for volunteers. Doing a drive, doing a fun thing, we're happy to come out to your group and speak. So there's a lot of things that we can do.
Finally, Jill, how do you measure your successes? In other words, how do you understand the impact that you're having? How do you look at whether you're being successful and doing the things that you really want to do?
You know, I think there's that opportunity to show your success. You know, we survey the guests and we take care of that, and I take that very seriously. But for me, it's that moment you get to watch, and it sounds silly, but when you watch a family go home and they're having that moment that some of us, you know, when my children were born, I got to take them home right away. And we have a lot of families that's not their story. And so watching them get in to take that step home, while nerve-wracking, it's exciting. It's, you know, it's happy for most of our families on the day they get to go home. And so when you get to see that, I think too, the follow-ups, you know, the Christmas cards that come, or the drop-ins of families that have been here before that just want to stop in and say hi, I think that's when you really know you've made a difference. I just think those are really special moments to be a part of.
Jill Christopher, she's the Chief Executive Officer at the Ronald McDonald House Charities of the Red River Valley here in Fargo. Jill, thanks for what you do.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. It was really fun.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. There is a lot of thought that goes into hunting season and determining how many animals can be hunted, and whether it's gun or bow or something else. Here is biologist Chuck Lura on how hunting seasons were determined by archaeological record.
What big game are hunted and why they are hunted has changed over the course of human history. I was thinking about that recently when I read an article in the scientific journal The Prairie Naturalist that analyzed animal remains in archaeological sites in the northern Great Plains to estimate the abundance and diversity of large herbivores that were hunted. Various hypotheses have been developed to explain the decline in large mammals since the last ice age. Some studies point to overhunting as a factor. Other studies point to climate change, changes in vegetation, or other factors. For most of human history, the primary reason for hunting was to obtain food, and species hunted was a function of the availability and animal size. During the late Pleistocene or Ice Age, 20,000 to 10,000 years before present, the archaeological evidence indicates over 24 species of large herbivores were hunted, with mammoths accounting for the largest portion. Other species hunted included 2 species of bison, camels, pronghorn, 2 species of deer, elk, and close relatives of today's horses and donkeys. During the Holocene, 10,000 years to 500 years before present, the diversity of remains in archaeological sites declined from 26 species to 10 species, and hunting shifted from largely mammoth to overwhelmingly bison, a large animal that traveled in large herds. Other species hunted included pronghorn, elk, moose, whitetail, and mule deer. The authors noted that in addition to the decrease in the number of species hunted, the size of the species hunted decreased as well. They also noted that these trends seem to be continuing to the present day. From 500 years before present to the present, hunting was largely related to commerce. The authors cite, for example, Prince Maximilian of Wied at Fort Union, near present-day Williston, reported that in 1833, the American Fur Company exported between 20,000 and 30,000 deer hides. Then European settlement in the 1870s and 80s resulted in the near extirpation of all the large herbivores in the northern Great Plains. These days, of course, hunting is regulated, and hunter preferences is for large antlers and horns. With several other factors, such as climate change, chronic wasting, and habitat loss, one cannot help but wonder what the future holds for our big game animals. I've put links to the homepage of the Great Plains Natural Science Society and the Prairie Naturalist, plus archival material along with the text of this natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
Still to come on Main Street, just in time for a big holiday gathering, a talk about respiratory illnesses.
Hi, I'm Tom Brusseau. I hope you'll join me every Saturday for the Great American Folk Show. You'll hear plenty of live music from across the spectrum of genres and from around the world. And we also feature artists and craftspeople, poets and storytellers, and there's always a current of North Dakota that flows through the program. You'll feel a real sense of place as you get to know our eateries and our writers and historians, and even in some cases, our historical reprisers. The Great American Folk Show airs every Saturday at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And just in time for big family gatherings, it's helpful to know how disease and illness can spread. Environmental engineer Lindsay Marr was confident that COVID was an airborne virus, even when the World Health Organization was saying otherwise. Today, we have an excerpt from Conversations on Healthcare as she discusses her insights and latest observations with hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. This conversation begins as she explains the research that led to the understanding of how the virus spreads.
Yeah, a lot of that was based on our research that had been going on for a decade before that on flu transmission. And we thought that a lot of respiratory viruses transmitted in the same way, even though we know the viruses are different from each other, maybe they're different in size and have different properties. They're carried in respiratory droplets and tiny particles that are emitted when we breathe, talk, cough, and sing, whether we are, and these droplets come out, whether we are infected or not. And really, it's the size of those droplets and the ability of the virus to survive in those droplets that dictates how the virus is going to transmit, how it's going to get from one person to another. And so what we found is that the virus, flu viruses, and then since it was later shown that SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, is released in tiny respiratory particles that are small enough that they can float around in the air for many hours, and that you can breathe these in and become infected both when you're close to a person, as if you are close to a cigarette smoker and breathing in a lot of their exhaled cigarette smoke, and also if you're farther away, because they can be carried great distances, and they can build up over time in a poorly ventilated room like cigarette smoke does. And so that can lead to exposure and infection, too.
We know the history of science and medicine is full of stories of very expert people like yourself who are brave and bucked conventional thinking. We're really curious on a personal level, where did you find the fortitude to proceed with this? Were you always convinced that the COVID virus would turn out to be airborne in this way that really changed the way we modified our public health protocols?
From what I was seeing coming out of China in December and January, I was pretty sure that the virus was transmitted through the airborne route. It was because the original SARS from 2004 was shown with pretty good evidence to be airborne. And then we saw how rapidly it was spreading in China. And then we saw photos of healthcare workers where they're wearing full respiratory protection. And, you know, people just don't wear that just for fun. You know, it's expensive, it's onerous, it's burdensome. And so I figured they were wearing it for good reason. And this was also based, of course, on what I knew mechanistically, kind of fundamental science about how viruses are released from people's noses and mouths and how they move around in the air. And so based on that, and then really what finally convinced me was seeing the Skagit Valley Corral outbreak in the U.S. in early March of 2020, where I think almost 90% of the attendees at that choir practice got infected, even though they knew the virus was present. They avoided shaking hands. They maintained their distance, but they were together vocalizing for a long period of time in a poorly ventilated environment. And so for me, that was kind of like the final thing. Although even right before that, I had posted on Twitter, you know, let's talk about airborne transmission of SARS-CoV-2, because we needed to clear up a lot of misunderstandings and incorrect assumptions. And you know, I wanted to present a more accurate view of how the virus is transmitted. And you know, the fortitude that really came from, I was pretty sure I was right because my knowledge was based on physics, and you cannot violate the rules of physics.
It's a good lesson for everybody.
You know, I'm wondering, some people think the COVID's in our rearview mirror, but it's not. And so many people are still looking for some guidance. When I go to these large events, should I be wearing a KN95 mask? Or how should I walk through this lifetime, given that COVID's still all around us? It's mutating all the time. I want to both be safe and I want to have a life. What's your secret sauce, if you will, that might give people some guidance, no assurances, but what's the best strategy in your mind?
Well, first of all, it comes down to your own personal risk tolerance, which is going to be affected by your own health conditions. If you're immunocompromised or you live with people who are, then you're going to take extra precautions. You know, how disruptive is it going to be to your work and life schedule if you're sick for a few days? You know, if it's not that disruptive, then you can afford to take a few more risks. But if you have some critical event coming up, maybe in the week ahead of time, you want to be extra careful. And so what I do is I think about these higher risk environments. And in those situations, I wear my N95 and I really pay attention to what's going on around me. And those are, you know, places where it's crowded, where if I hear people coughing, of course, if I'm in the airplane while we're still on the ground, when the ventilation system may not be running. And I've heard a lot of people who have been getting sick recently, COVID and other respiratory diseases when traveling. You know, that's common. We're in these big crowded environments, and that's where these viruses are floating around the air. It's very easy to if they happen to be there, you're going to be exposed. And, in some cases, your immune system can fight it off. In some cases, it can't.
You've talked about on the tarmac The plane is still not engaged. It's not turning the air. What about for hospital healthcare facilities? What's your recommendation for the amount of times that air should turn? Or for most people who are listening in their own home, what can they do?
Well, hospitals have to follow existing regulations and guidelines, which are that they have to have at least 6 air changes per hour. So the air in a room changes over 6 times, is replaced with cleaner outdoor air, filtered air in patient rooms. And then I believe in surgical theaters and other critical areas that it has to be 12 air changes per hour, which means at least every 5 minutes the air is changing out. Now, the hospitals really have excellent ventilation, because if we think about our homes and other places, we typically see more like half an air change per hour, meaning it takes 2 hours for that air to change over, or maybe up to 3 air changes per hour at best. The CDC is now recommending 5 air changes per hour in every public place. And, you know, that would be could be your home, too, if someone's infected and you want to increase ventilation, reduce the risk of transmission to family members. I think the critical places to focus on this, though, are things like schools, where lots of kids together for long periods of the day. And the ventilation there is usually well below the recommended value of 5 air changes per hour.
Professor Marr, you wrote in the New York Times recently about COVID and the link to wildfire smoke and gas stoves and what this tells us about air quality. Explain this for us. We may not see the connection the way you do.
It's that there's something in the air that we are breathing in, whether it is the COVID virus or whether it is wildfire smoke particles or gases and particles that are emitted by gas stoves and cooking. And these can have really strong impacts on our health that I think we didn't appreciate as much until the pandemic came around and we realized that it was an airborne virus. I'll make an analogy to our drinking water. And everybody knows that they shouldn't drink dirty water. And if somebody hands you a glass of dirty water, you're not going to drink that. In the air, the same really should be true, that we should try to avoid breathing dirty air. It is bad for our health. It causes short-term effects like coughing and wheezing, exacerbates asthma, and it also causes long-term effects. It contributes to cardiovascular disease. Air pollution is one of the leading causes of death, premature death worldwide. It's responsible for 7 to 8 million premature deaths, as estimated by the World Health Organization.
You know, scientists and researchers like yourself are running into lots of controversy. So we must ask you about the gas stove controversy. And the House of Representatives passed a bill to block any possible ban on gas stoves, even as regulators look into the potential health hazards of gas stove emissions. So let me ask you to explain these health hazards and how severe they are.
Yeah, well, gas stoves burn methane. And when you have any high temperature combustion, you can form a pollutant called nitrogen oxides. And nitrogen dioxide is one of the EPA's 6 criteria pollutants, meaning that we have outdoor regulations for it because it causes respiratory irritation, things like coughing and wheezing and exacerbation of asthma. And so you're emitting that into your home, and it can cause similar effects, of course, in your home. As far as the level of those effects, it's not clear. There have been some studies. I don't know that we have the smoking gun type of evidence yet to say that, oh, in all situations, all gas stoves are terrible. Certainly, if you have good exhaust, really strong exhaust ventilation, that will help mitigate any risk. But bans on it, it seems silly. It's like, I don't know, just seems premature.
That was Conversations on Healthcare podcast hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter speaking with environmental engineer Lindsay Marr. A movie review with Madeline is next.
Lots of listeners have complimented Ashley Thornburg's interviewing skills over the years, and so have plenty of her guests.
Hi, my name is Bonnie Sommerfeld. I'm from Fargo, North Dakota, originally Valley City, North Dakota. I love all things Main Street. I'm a total fan. And when I come in to be interviewed by Ashley, it's so wonderful. I'm asked questions that are poignant, and I learn things about myself by answering the questions that I did not even know I had or that existed. So I just always look forward to it, and I hope everybody else does too.
If you appreciate thoughtful questions and hosts that take the time to listen, then step up and support Main Street and all the things you enjoy on Prairie Public with a gift of financial support. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the red link that says donate.
And there's the fanfare. That means it's time for one thing and one thing only, our weekly movie review with Matt O'Lean. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be here.
So, Matt, we're going to review the movie X this week.
Not much to see in theaters this past weekend, because I already saw The Holdovers. I saw Priscilla. I'm waiting for Saltburn. I'm waiting for Napoleon. I'm waiting for Poor Things. And I don't want to see The Marvels, which was the weakest box office opening for a Marvel film ever, which, again, that's a subject for another day, but I do think that superhero fatigue is finally real.
I think I agree with you, Matt. I really do.
I think it is officially set in. So, a couple months ago, I reviewed Pearl, the 2022 slasher film with Mia Goth, and so I thought, let's watch X, which was the same director, same star, so the writer-director is Ty West, Mia Goth again in this. And this was the first film of last year of the X franchise. Then Pearl came out, which was a prequel, which covered, you know, Mia Goth as Pearl in the World War I Texas, and she goes crazy on the farm. So now this is the first film. It's called X. It's set in 1979. It's a film crew that goes out to this farmstead where Pearl now lives, Pearl and her husband Howard, and they're about 82 years old now, and look it. Mia Goth plays both Pearl and Maxine, who's part of the film crew, and they're going to shoot a porn movie in 1979 at this farmstead in Texas. Brittany Snow is in it. Jenna Ortega, who's now hit it really big as Wednesday and the Addams Family. Mia Goth again. Martin Henderson plays Wayne, kind of the executive producer of the porn film. And so they're shooting it as kind of this artistic 70s porn film, which was kind of the rage at that time before everything went video. You know, try to make an artistic porn film is what they're trying to do in the middle of Texas. And they've got clearance from Howard to shoot on the property. But of course, this is a slasher film. And so the shooting of the porn movie is much like the MacGuffin of the money being stolen in Psycho by Janet Leigh. It's a MacGuffin for what's really going to happen. And all heck is going to break loose. Like this one a lot. I think I like Pearl a little better. This one has that slow burn feel that Ty West so vividly did in Pearl. You're not sure what's going on at first. You get to know the characters first, and I like that. So we get to know these characters who are shooting the pornography film, and you kind of sympathize with them, and you know darn well not all of them are going to make it through the movie. But I like the style of Ty West shooting. We kind of see images, too, of what the film is going to look like, the porn film that they're shooting. So then it looks like 70s kind of film, but really good characterizations by all the actors. And Mia Goth plays the dual role. And let me just say, the old age makeup they use on her as Pearl is amazing. I still think the best old age makeup is Little Big Man with Dustin Hoffman back in 1970, but this is really good. The number they do on, you know, 20-something Mia Goth to make her look 80-something. I think what makes these films work so well, Craig, is they're set in kind of this rural Texas setting. We now know the backstory of Pearl if we've seen Pearl. So now I can watch X and kind of get the updated. And I suspect the success of these two films, both with critics and commercially, we now have an X franchise, much like Evil Dead, much like Saw. We can expect another movie with Mia Goth. Now, in this movie, her younger performance, she plays Maxine, one of the porn stars in the movie. So we really get to see her acting chops as well. And we really got to see her acting chops as Pearl, which was the film set in about 1918 in Texas. So I like this a lot. Maybe outstayed its welcome by about 10 minutes. That's possible, I would say. But the shocks when they come are well done. Like this movie, and I'm not a big slasher guy at all, but I really like what Ty West is doing with this franchise.
Of course, this movie is rated R. There's kind of two sides to it, right? The exploitation part and then the slashing part. Either
yes.
One of those trouble you at all, or was it generally put together, as you might expect, very predictable in my eyes?
Yeah, I think both were handled pretty well for a slasher movie. Naturally, there are going to be scenes of them shooting the actors in the porn movie. But those are done, I think, very tastefully. Obviously, this is a commercial film. It's not a porn film. We're not going to see what we people who watch porn would see in a porn movie. But it's very funny how they think they're making this artistic movie. And that's really their goal out there. And they, of course, have more than they bargained for with Old Howard and Old Pearl. And I would say that the gore when it comes, look, people who go to slasher films, Craig, they want gore. They want some blood. It's not excessive, I wouldn't say. It's very predictable for a slasher film, but I was comfortable with it.
So much the soundtrack plays into these slasher movies that really get you going. Same here?
Yeah, Fear the Reaper by Blue Oyster Cult plays a very key role and a key scene, I would say. That's really well done. Of course, that came out in about 1976. The setting here is 1979. So again, we get a good feel from late 70s rock and roll and things like that.
So you get a little bit of a feel for the cultural and social settings of the time.
Yes. Oh, for sure. The hair is perfect. Everyone has bad 1979 hair going, especially the men who don't look good at all. The main actor in the porn film is like an ex-Marine from Vietnam, African-American actor, and he really gives a nice performance. I liked his performance a lot. And so we get a little cross-section of everybody. And I would say this film is Texas Chainsaw Massacre meets Hardcore meets Psycho. Do you remember the movie Hardcore with George C. Scott, where he's searching for his daughter who has disappeared in the porn world? There's a little bit of that here, and I'm not going to say what's going on or why that's a key part of this film, but just hold on to your hats for that part.
I remember the title of the movie, mm-hmm. but I will be honest, I did not see the movie.
Yeah.
All right, Matt, what you have cooking for us coming down the road?
I think next week we'll review Saltburn. That's the new film by writer-director Emerald Fennell, who gave us Promising Young Woman in 2020 with Carey Mulligan. Napoleon is coming out that Thanksgiving as well, so those are probably the next two.
And, of course, you're pleased that the actor strike is now history.
Goodness, thankful for that. I think the Oscar show is going to happen now. That was kind of in question, too, whether that was even going to happen or they're just going to announce the winners online. Who knows?
All right. Speaking of the Oscars, let's go for trivia for the week. Matt, what movie starring Russell Crowe as a Roman general won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 2001?
Gladiator.
Easy for you.
Very easy.
And we've been to the movies with Matt Olien. We're Main Streets Ahead. Stay with us.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 22nd. It might be surprising to learn how early the snowmobile was invented. It was on this date, in 1927, that the United States Patent Office granted a patent for a motor toboggan to Wisconsin native Carl Eliason. He was ahead of his time as he dreamed of a motorized vehicle that could travel on snow. In 1924, he tested a prototype of what he called the motor toboggan and obtained the patent 3 years later. His machine seems quite primitive compared with modern snowmobiles, but it worked. It was a wooden toboggan with two skis steered by ropes and propelled by a specially adapted 2.5-horsepower Johnson outboard motor. Eliason began building motor toboggans in his Saner, Wisconsin shop. By the 1940s, he received more orders than the shop could handle. So a company in Clintonville, Wisconsin, took over production. In 1947, production moved again to Kitchener, Ontario. Eliason motor toboggans were produced until the 1960s. Eliason was not the first person to dream of motorized winter travel. The patent office issued a patent for a snow vehicle as early as 1896, but nothing came of it. In Canada, Joseph Bombardier developed a snow vehicle, but it never went into wide production. Eliason's 1927 machine stands out because it was both mass-produced and reliable. Many snowmobile enthusiasts consider North Dakota an excellent destination for snowmobile adventures. There are 14 state snowmobile trails covering over 2,800 miles. Volunteers from Snowmobile North Dakota help keep the trails well-groomed. A 2007 survey reported that the most popular destination is the Peace Garden Trail. North Dakota gets high marks for both the number of trails and the quality. The North Dakota app makes it easy to track a snowmobiler's location on the trail, get updates on trail conditions, and locate nearby amenities. The survey noted that snowmobilers spend money on equipment, clothing, and accessories, as well as snowmobiling vacations. North Dakota businesses that benefit from the sport include hotels, restaurants, and gas stations. Snowmobiles have become big business in North Dakota, so here's a tip of the hat to inventor Carl Eliason. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, it's Thanksgiving. We learn what that is like for some people experiencing Thanksgiving for the very first time. We also have a food discussion with Main Street Eats' Sue Balcom. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Happy Thanksgiving.